KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Good morning. Joining me now in the studio with our trails update, Charlie Sturgis from Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as we talked about, I think it was last year, right, that Mountain Trails lost the lease on the rail trail?
Contract.
Contract, yeah. So who's now responsible for the maintenance of that?
I'm actually not 100% sure. Ultimately, the go-to people would be the state parks. It is a state park. They hired a different contractor. You know, we talked about a little bit about this last year. We didn't think the new contract, the new way of managing things was basically financially viable. There's a lot of major capital improvement issues that need to be dealt with, and they were sort of sticking it to the contractor. And I'm like, oh, well, there's no way. So if you are having issues out there at any given time, please, you can always send me an email, and I'll try to get it over to the state parks guys. But even the guys that we started with last year, which were new, are not there at the moment. So there's a seems to be a little bit of revolving door going on at the moment.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because there's, the asphalt certainly needs some fixing.
Love.
I mean, there's lots of. But I mean, and this, I guess, they're specifically just west of the Comstock intersection. There's a kind of a low-hanging tree, which it's not on the rail trail. It's next to the rail trail, but I've almost knocked myself out a few times.
It's in the easement.
Mm.
So the rail trail is, you know, 12, 14 feet wide as we see it. The actual legal easement is about... It varies a little bit, anywhere from probably 25 to 50 feet to either side.
So that
tree
state park
that,
would be responsible for making sure that tree is not a liability, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess if you really feel like it's in your way and a little bit of a hazard, every once in a while, it's just easier to go get your little saw and cut it down, clip it out of the way, right?
Oh, I won't get in trouble then, huh?
No, we won't be pursuing you.
Yeah, and what about, though, I mean, because that brings up a good point just about trees and bushes on private property that kind of overhang or overcrowd sidewalks and other pathways.
Technically, if, you know, I think the, and I'm not a legal expert, I believe that anytime that something is overhanging a piece of property that is like your piece of property, but it's your neighbor's tree, you have the right to cut it back to the property line. What we normally would think of at Mountain Trails is how can we increase the level of safety? So if something's hanging in over our trail or, like you said, over the rail trail, we would want to cut it out of the way just to basically increase safety. And we've done this along McLeod Creek some. We actually removed a tree over there on payday once because it blocked your ability to see traffic coming before you crossed the crosswalk. And it was this old scraggly tree. So we just basically take that kind of thing down and out of the way.
Yeah. And now, like, Mountain Trails received, scheduled to receive a special services grant for $10,000, I think. What will you do?
Well, you're ahead of me.
What will you do with that money?
That one, is, if it's from the city that you're referring to, from Park City, that is a winter grant. So that's only for wintertime.
Okay.
So that covers, and it's 2 years. So it's $5,000 per season for managing the grooming efforts out in Round Valley, which last year probably was a bargain for us. 2 years ago, we probably spent $30,000 out there. It's really nice to get a little help wherever we can. But certainly our donor base is primary in terms of funding that kind of operation.
Okay. So again, like the bushes that are kind of impeding the trail there, Poison Creek Trail, they're right at the intersection of Iron Horse, which again is a hazard if you're coming from one of the locations. That's the city's responsibility?
That's the city's, yeah, for the most part. Every once in a while, the city will call us and go, hey, can you take care of X? And we just go out there and do it because maybe we're in the area. Things that are technically basically part of the transportation corridor and are part of the city infrastructure, that's not really our responsibility. We're much more a city contractor managing things, basically dirt trails for the city.
Okay. What else you got going on?
A couple things, actually. You'll like this. First off, as of yesterday, Jenny's is reconnected. So now you can ride the upper section of Jenny's. I think it's first time. Has it been three seasons?
Mm-hmm. Well, it starts, right?
Yeah.
Kind of half of a season,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But missing out on that upper almost 2 miles of Jenny's certainly is, it's been different. It's been a drag. Also, coming at us next week, end of next week, there will be a reroute of Mid-Mountain over at the Red Pine Lodge because of the lift reconstruction and, you know, everything that's being taken down and staging areas, it means that you still will have access to bathrooms and food and all that. You'll simply actually get probably what is a nicer reroute. They're going to utilize the nature trail and keep you going that way. So that's actually pretty cool. Also, we're near completion, but we're not. So you will find that we're still have the entry to the new trail on Round Valley is still taped off. So this is the directional down that's going down to Old Ranch Road parking lot that we see also as a part of a logical loop when you take Happy Gilmore to TM to this mile and a half of designated downhill flow trail. So we'll be... I guess I'd say follow us on Facebook. We'll obviously put it out there as soon as we can. But we're looking at 2 weeks. It is fairly completed, but we still haven't finished doing all the turns and so forth and rock stuff. So if you can avoid being in there, that's nice. I know it's hard not to be curious and get in there. We will be starting up on the Crescent Project probably in another week. Actually, we'll be starting right after we get done with the first leg of the Triple Trail Challenge, which is coming up Saturday after this. You can actually still sign up. You can sign up for the race individually as a half marathon. You can sign up as a 7K, which we added this year, just kind of make it a little bit more casual for everybody. And, of course, if you're signing up for the Triple Trail Challenge, this is one of the events you have to do for that series of events. Outside of that...
What's the Crescent Project?
Oh, the Crescent Project. I guess we might have talked about it a while ago. The Crescent Project is a project we'll be doing up at PCM, which will take riders and hikers, more likely riders, from the Crescent Lift Yurt area down north, down along probably what is the top of the Ski Team Ridge area, and join into Mid-Mountain approximately over where the bench is by Rosebud. And that will be a one-way directional trail. It'll be designed to be as easy as you can make it in the mountains. You know, as I said, you know, there's no beginner consequences in the mountains, right? You know, you can have a beginner trail, but still, if you fall off a 40-degree slope, you're going to get hurt. So as much as we can make it a beginner. And this will open up the door, hopefully, and it won't. This door won't open until we actually finish this trail, but making Tommy Two Step a one way up for bikes as well. So try to once again, if we're going to basically try to manage some of the traffic issues and kind of multi directional issues, having Tommy's become up only for cycling will of course eliminate washboard and things like that, wear and tear on the trail a lot like Armstrong, and also hopefully will reduce. Sort of a number of conflicts that we do see because it's a central location, that whole area right there by the Yurt is, you know, lots of people coming and going both ways. So you'll have Mojave to go down. You'll have this new trail to go down to Mid-Mountain, which would be the logical way to continue over to Deer Valley if you want it. You'll still have the steps. So there'll be a lot of options, but this will also be, once again, a nice designated downhill flow trail.
All right. And what about Spiro? Has that been... designated? I mean, it's being used as mostly downhill, but people still ride it.
When we surveyed it last year, you know, surveyed that question, what to do with Spiro, 50% of the survey respondents were basically, I ride up it. I mean, to me, I think it's a drag. I mean, I think the washboard is just way too big. Maybe my back's too old, right? But, you know, we have encouraged and put out in front of with PCM some thoughts on doing a whole new Spiro that would actually go towards the base. It's not necessarily an easy project. It definitely covers some steep terrain. No one's really settled in on what the best way to do that would be. So that is not occurring at the moment, but it's certainly out there in the hopper, and I think there's awareness that driving traffic back to the base, especially if it started at the base, you know, was lift assisted and so forth, and getting it back to the base would be important. So we'll see. I think maybe that's, you know, keep queuing that conversation up. But I know maybe next year, maybe that's something to get on the plan.
Okay, so mountaintrails.org if people want to register.
Please, yeah, and once again, you know, your race fees do support our trail building efforts. So it's really important that we have our races be as full and as high a level of participants as we can.
Okay, Charlie, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:20. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now on the phone is with a look at some of the development projects in and around Summit County. I have Community Development Director Pat. Pat, good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So in the last month since we've talked, any significant development applications that have come over the counter but haven't maybe made it to Planning Commission at this point?
So we have sort of a brief hiatus where we're kind of catching our breath over here. No real new significant projects that haven't daylighted in front of the commission, only with the exception of a project out in the Silver Creek area called the Marketplace at Silver Creek. That's on our agenda for the Planning Commission for an introduction work session at 4:30 in the afternoon, and that's a project that people, I think, will be familiar with the site. It's across the road from the Home Depot. It's really two pieces of property that total 20 acres. If you're coming into the roundabout on your way to go pick up materials at Home Depot, if it was a clock, it was roughly at 1 o'clock. And that's a project that is contemplated to be mixed use. So it's going to have some retail commercial, it'll have some office, it'll have some residential. The residential is contemplated to be a mix of both workforce housing and market housing. It's got a number of unique attributes about it, and we want to begin the discussion with the Planning Commission. Candidly, as designed, there are some elements of the plan that don't meet the underlying zoning requirements. It's zoned community commercial out that in that area. And so there are a couple of provisions in that zone that, one, limits the overall size of any retail space. The other is some height limitations. And in this particular project idea, there's a proposal by the property owner, the applicant, to have a space there that's a little over 60,000 square feet, and what is intended in that space would be a grocery store. Right now, the zone doesn't allow that. So we want to have a conversation with the Planning Commission about that, as well as is there any consideration that we want to maybe go back and rethink the zone or rethink some of our zoning tools to address that. And we'll wait and see what they have to say. If the answer is yes, we'll go back and maybe come up with some concepts and ideas. Sort of at the heart of this, what this makes this somewhat unique is some of the uses that are being proposed, like the grocery store. The Silver Summit area is it's growing, and it's anticipated to have more growth. This is the broader neighborhood that has the Silver Creek Village area. And the thought out there, the thesis is out there, is that if we were able to provide some neighborhood services out there, like a grocery store, can we capture trips that would otherwise head out to the junction or the back door into Park City, and can we use that as possibly a traffic mitigator regionally? How that works in terms of dealing with traffic locally in the neighborhood is another thing that we'll need to explore. But that's really the big new project on the horizon. We certainly have a lot of stuff going on elsewise here out in the Canyons area and in the Junction as well.
So 60,000 square feet, that's too big for a Trader Joe's. Can you lobby the developer to, do we really need another Fresh Market?
That's probably not for me to be able to weigh in on in terms of what the needs are. I'll leave that to more expert people. In terms of creating some of those neighborhood services, yeah, I think it's worth having that dialogue about having a grocery store out there, whether it would be a smaller Harmon's, a Trader Joe's, a Sprouts or something like that. Anything that we can do to begin to make neighborhoods more complete, more whole, have services that don't require them to necessarily get in their car and drive elsewhere and create congestion is something that we need to look carefully at.
Another topic, we had heard that in the lower Silver Creek area, this is on that northwest corner, just as you kind of get onto I-80 from the flyover there at US 40, there's some large homes being built and apparently having some groundwater problems. Developers, my understanding is they have pumps going constantly. This is the property, I believe, once held by Anderson Development, which said that they were undertaking drainage to cure some water issues that were caused by UDOT as a result of this new intersection that we built for the Olympics. Neighbors back then suspected that they were draining regulated wetlands. So what are you aware of there?
So that area out there in Lower Silver Creek, that was the old Anderson property. That was acquired by Woodside Homes. That neighborhood that's being constructed out there is East Canyon Ranches. That subdivision, that neighborhood was platted many, many years ago, going back into the 60s. I think that was like the Johnson administration during the Great Society. It goes back that far. And so those home sites are already platted, and by virtue of that, they have vested rights. So simply said, they have the ability to build homes out there. They do have high groundwater in that area, and my understanding is that many, if not all of the homes in that area have sump pumps, and depending on which lots we're talking about, some of them are running, depending on the time of the season, a lot, if not 24 hours a day, to deal with that groundwater. In terms of the impacts on jurisdictional wetlands, I have not been made aware of any work or any concerns that's been brought to us by the Corps of Engineers. In terms of, like, you know, the individual homes pumping, I think what they're doing is just dealing with that problem. They're having water inside the home, and they're taking that and pumping it back out in the yard. I don't want to go as far as saying it's a closed system, but I think it's an ongoing issue that a lot of the homeowners in that area have to deal with. I am not aware, Leslie, of any specific work prior to those homes being built done by the property owner, UDOT, or someone else that has been done somehow affecting the jurisdictional wetlands. I'm happy to look into that, but to date, I haven't been approached, nor do I believe Public Works or Engineering's been approached with that either.
Yeah, and I don't really know the situation there, but I mean, I guess fortunately, Utah is such a dry community. But I mean, any concerns about perhaps mold issues in the homes? I mean, and who oversees that? The planning department or the health department?
Probably a combination of both. Obviously, when the homes go through their permitting, making sure that, one, we have homes that are built in a manner. You know, we don't have any floodplain issues there, so it's not an issue of making sure we have a main level finished floor elevation that's at a specific height above the ground, but making sure that there's adequate ventilation, making sure in those areas that, and again, where they are likely to be prone to groundwater, that they have sufficient systems in place to drain that. Mold is a aspect that is always going to be, you know, reviewed on an ongoing basis. We're not doing inspections in those. The health department doesn't go and inspect those on a regular basis. But if there are concerns that are brought to us by property owners, we will do an inspection and investigate, and if necessary, offer some assistance and recommendations on how those could be better addressed. But that's an ongoing situation for the residents in that area.
All right. And finally, I wanted to ask you about South Point. When this comes to County Council, or have you seen any new revised plans after the Planning Commission kind of turned down what they saw earlier?
We haven't seen any revised plans, and as of 8:29 on Friday morning, here's what we have in terms of a schedule. We have a public hearing scheduled with the County Council on June 20th. Late yesterday afternoon, I received an email from the applicant's representative requesting that that be postponed. We were the dilemma with this here is the public notices have already gone out. Has this happened before where notices have gone out and, you know, we have people being told that there's going to be a public hearing and request to continue? That happens occasionally. We're going to be having a discussion both in-house and probably a discussion with them on what the appropriate thing to do is. Obviously, we want to be responsive to the request of the applicant and find out a little bit more the reason behind the request for the postponement. But we also want to make sure that we're doing right by our residents out there that may be making plans to attend this meeting. And sometimes people travel from out of state to attend these meetings. So this is what I know today. There's a public hearing scheduled for the 20th of June. There has been no formal decision whether to table that. I'll be happy to let you as well as the public and everyone know if there's a decision to move off that date or not. So meeting on the 20th so far, we haven't seen any changes to the plan from what the Planning Commission forwarded a recommendation on, I think, back in December.
All right. And then maybe you can still help me with my long-going confusion. You know, we were told that South Point is not Promontory, and yet all of Promontory's affordable housing is in South Point. That was an agreement that was made back in 2016 that basically located the affordable housing for Promontory in South Point, and then at the same time legally established a separate development agreement and separate developers. So if it's a separate development, how is it now responsible for Promontory's affordable housing? Won't it have its own affordable housing to deal with as a separate development?
I'm not gonna attempt to put on my and pull up my attorney socks on this one and weigh in on that. I'm gonna leave that to the attorneys on the nuances of that. I think the best way to describe this to the community is South Point is part or under an umbrella of a larger Promontory specially planned area. It's a subset of that. Now, as a subset of that, based on the development agreement that was executed and recorded a number of years ago, there was a provision in there that I believe allowed the developer to identify, move that obligation from one portion of the spa area to another. I think it would be inaccurate to say that this is different than Promontory. It's a subset of Promontory, and I'm going to leave it to the attorneys on both sides to try and articulate that. I think the key aspect of that is there's an affordable housing obligation associated with that. There's been a significant amount of development that's occurred over the years. I think there's probably somewhere north of 130 employees currently working there. And the county has just simply asked the question, you know, Promontory, where are we? South Point, where are we with moving forward and developing a specific employee housing, workforce housing plan that was required under that DA? Now, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. It would be great if there was a bit more flesh on the bone of that development agreement provision that talks about workforce housing as, you know, what's going to trigger it and how much, when. It doesn't have that kind of language in that. And I think that's what the Eastside Planning Commission wants to have better definition on and a better understanding and a commitment when these things are going to happen. We had a joint work session with the Eastside Planning Commission and the County Council a number of months ago. I can't speak for the council, but I think they share that question. I think the end objective is you know, we need a plan. We need to know how, what, where, and under, you know, what how this is going to be ultimately accommodated with, because like any other development area in the community, we want to make sure that we have that provision for our workforce housing in there. That's related to but somewhat separate than the whole discussion about the request for the increase in the entitlements in this particular subset area. And I think that's why, you know, from a staff perspective, we think it's appropriate to be able to get this in front of the council in the format of a public hearing so that the public has an opportunity to listen to what is being proposed on this project and probably more importantly, weigh in with comments and questions and in some cases some concerns that we can move this through to ultimately getting a decision made. And I believe the property owner and the developer is owed a decision. And we're looking at the 20th as being that date. If that changes here in the very near horizon, as in today, I'm going to make sure we go above and beyond to make sure that everybody involved is aware of when the next meeting date may be, if we have one.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Pat, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
The Park City Council met yesterday with a full agenda, everything from the budget to traffic calming on Hillside Avenue. In the studio with a recap, I have Councilmember Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Leslie.
The council reviewed some recommendations from staff on some new special events policies. Council, I think, generally agreeing on the changes, didn't have consensus on some of the items. But let's talk. Apparently, we're talking about now setting 10 peak weeks where there would be blackouts. So that would mean we absolutely add no additional events to those peak weeks?
Yeah, that's the idea. They're actually... These are pretty significant changes, and just to frame it for you and the listeners, you know, we've heard for a number of years, and it's been kind of a growing issue, about the number of events and the impacts of those events on our community and how to find the right balance and the sweet spot and which events are appropriate and which events aren't appropriate and all that. And we've done a lot of things that were, you know, steps in the direction of trying to achieve that proper balance. And this is the latest iteration of that process. And from my perspective, and I think all of council's, we're very pleased. we're very pleased that staff is giving us the ability at council to, as I say, have a spine when it comes to the issue of events, because what happens is we try to create these parameters and these criteria that, in effect, are tools that we can use. And then when we're confronted with the ask from our local nonprofits, we tend not to be able to comply with our own guidelines. So this is a really... These were really, I would say, much more aggressive steps, and that is one of them, is creating these blackout dates where we will not add any additional events.
And those 10 weeks, I mean, are we talking like Arts Festival,
yeah.
Save of the Summit? I mean, what are those?
Those are the ones, yes. So we are looking at those as the peak times when they're not only... Well, they do tend to revolve around events because our events tend to revolve around the calendar. So there's a nice synchronicity there. So we're looking at, yes, those big events that are in the peak of the season. And we're saying nothing on top of this. And it doesn't matter. You know, this is a hard and fast rule. It doesn't matter who you show up with to plead your case. We're going to stick to these blackout dates because, you know, we finally are going to be forced to do so.
Even when the, as I think you put it, the kittens, puppies, and children events come.
Crying children, yes, all those.
So that's when you would say, sorry, no.
That's correct.
Let's see. In terms of the designating some quiet weeks, at least those that would only have L1 or L2, maybe you could just quickly define for us. I mean, it goes L1 through L5?
That's new. We have in the past had level 1 through level 3. The level 3s have been the big ones. And now we are going to take those largest of the level threes and break them out into fours and fives. And staff was very clear that those are actually kind of the different events that have they flow out into a lot of different departments and a lot of different issues for the community with noise and with traffic and with congestion and with the need for additional public safety. So it puts a financial burden on our police department and a resource and taxes our police department. Health, safety, and welfare issues. The level three, two, and ones don't tend to do that. And you can think in terms of Tour de Suds. You know, Tour de Suds has some impacts, but it certainly doesn't cause those level four and five type impacts. It's a big event, but we don't have extra police. We don't have people blocking off roads. We don't have transportation issues. Think of Sundance. We do. So Sundance is a level five. Tour de Suds is a one or two. And because of the size, you know, if you have a really big Tour de Suds one year, it could possibly bump into the level three. But those are different types of events. We also, our staff is also recommending that we deregulate at the base of the resorts the ones, twos, and threes. So they would be exempt. If you have a one, two, or three that is held at the base of Park City Mountain Resort or Deer Valley, that falls under a different process, and it doesn't really have to go through this permitting process with the city.
Even though there would be definitely traffic impacts with some of those larger events.
Not one, twos, and threes. If it's a four or five, then we are going to regulate it. But one, twos, and threes would be deregulated and allowed to happen.
Got it. So the consensus was that it may take a while then to actually designate these quiet weeks.
Well, yeah, we want to kind of phase it in to give everybody a bit of a heads up. And we already we're into the season, so it would be difficult to put these in place with the applications that we have already come through. But by next summer, we hope to have them in place and actually for this winter season as well.
Okay, so like Tour of Utah, is that a level three,
That's
four, or five?
Four or five. Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably a five.
And you guys went ahead and approved that because it had to be approved for, I mean, they've already announced that they were coming here without the approvals in place, official approvals in place.
Yeah, and that would be one of those that we would it would be quasi-grandfathered. They would have kind of the first right of refusal or a preference for that date. And as long as they continued to hold that date and didn't change the event, like Sundance, like Arts Fest, they would be the one that was there, and you couldn't have others layered on top.
All right. Protecting the shoulder season, this was not quite a consensus here. I mean, I guess we're talking about spring and fall. A couple of council members felt that we really don't have to protect the season. The reasoning is what? It's so risky for a big event to be held in, you know,
yeah,
unknown weather.
Right. So the feeling that the consensus we arrived at, I think everybody felt that the shoulder seasons are somewhat special, and it's a nice exhale for the community. I have personally loved the last couple of months in town. And so we all agreed on that. But at the same time, we disagreed on whether there was a need for regulating and thus protecting that through regulation. And the consensus we arrived at was that because of weather, because of the fact that we haven't seen a bunch of big fours and fives drop into the shoulder season, that we probably will not. And therefore, we don't need to put regulations in place. We don't need to be proactive. In this instance, we can be reactive. If we see that happening, we could then reconsider whether or not we need to regulate and thus protect the shoulder seasons.
All right. And then looking at fiscal year 2019, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, council generally agreed that they would give fee waivers to some special events up to $300,000?
One time, we're going from our normal $200,000 line item fee waiver, budgeted fee waiver amount to $300,000, and that's because we've had a bunch of extraordinary events this year with the Park City Institute, for example, chewing up a quarter of our fee waiver budget right off the bat. And we, as Jenny Dearson pointed out, she's already used the budget for this year and needs additional, or we're going to be seeing every request for $4,000 and $5,000 and $6,000. And if we do this, then the city staff can administratively take care of those smaller ones. Anything over $25,000 request would still come before city council. And it is one time, and we're going to have to look at this in the future.
Let's talk briefly about some conversation during public comment. You heard from a couple of folks, Mike Sweeney and Micah Brill, director of Historic Main Street Business Alliance, saying that for the first Silly Sunday weekend, the parking fees, which are $5 an hour, drove parking away too much and have dampened shopping on the rest of Main Street.
And we're going to see. You know, we have another Sunday coming up. We're going to leave it in place for the second Sunday, so we'll have two Sundays to look at the data. We certainly do not want to drive people away from Main Street. And the idea, as Mike points out, is to, you know, draw people in and create vibrancy to the top of Main Street. We have plenty of vibrancy on the bottom of Main Street during the Silly Market. That has been a big success from that standpoint. From a purely technical perspective, and bear with me on this one, but from a purely technical perspective, it was effective. We reduced congestion. Traffic flow was great. The roads weren't packed. Over 200 cars, I think the count was 260, parked out at the high school. First time ever that we filled up the high school lots. So if you're looking at it from those type of criteria, huge success. If you're looking at it from a merchant on the top of Main Street perspective, and you walk outside and you see, you know, a lot of space on Main Street, and you walk over to China Bridge and it's half empty, you go, this is killing me. And your head count is down, and your walkthrough is down, and your sales are down. You're saying, this is killing me. So we have to look at this. It was great input. And, you know, this is what it's about. We're collecting data and we're getting input, and we will hopefully quickly find the proper balance on pricing, and it'll work for, you know, hopefully everybody.
Looking at the budget, some discussion with regard to water rate fees. Staff now saying that the rate increases will be 3% for the coming fiscal year rather than 6%, which is great.
Yep.
But why would they propose 6% if they didn't need it?
Well, let's see. What was the reason that we dropped it down?
Well, I think part of it was just, as you know, it's like now we're going to add, you know, 6% onto your water fees. And if treasurer approves, we're going to add another $200+ on your property
taxes.
Yeah,
but I'm just trying to remember why the adjustment from 6 to 3. And we talked about that, but it was a week ago. And I just can't remember the exact justification for why. But it was good that we were able to. And it might have something to do with I'd hate to throw out what that was. I don't recall the exact justification for that reduction.
But what's not going to happen, and I guess this is, you know, if in fact that we're trying to reduce fees to make things more affordable in the event Treasure Bond is approved, does that mean that then we get a 10% increase in water rates instead of incremental 3?
No, the water rates are not related to Treasure at all. It's completely different funding. It's an enterprise fund. So the fees from water use and the meter rates, that all pays for the programs and the capital improvements that are going on at the water department. So it's completely separate from Treasure. It does fit into the overall affordability conversation that we're having, but water rates are going to continue to go up. This is the first time in many years that we've only seen an adjustment that would be called kind of a CPI or an inflationary adjustment, as opposed to an inflation plus a little extra to get us up to the level of charging what water is really worth and what it costs to deliver. So we've actually gotten there. We've gotten to the level where we're now paying for the true cost of water, which I think should be, you know, reassuring to people. They're not going to see the big increases anymore. They're going to see more of these sort of 3% increases, which is really inflationary.
All right. With regard to Treasurer, did the council decide what the bond amount will be? And if not, when will that be done?
We gave guidance. There were a majority who felt that the 50.7 was the appropriate amount to shoot for. But it's, you know, 50.7 or 55. We're in that band. And we did give we didn't authorize it officially. We didn't vote to approve, but we gave direction to budget with the 50.7, and we will decide at the next budget meeting.
All right. And we're only talking about $20 between the two per year. So, I mean, really, 20 bucks? What's that? A buck, $2 a month?
Well, to your previous point, from an affordability standpoint, every $20 helps. I mean, that's kind of how we're looking at this. And we're deferring some projects. And, you know, kind of the unintended consequence from my perspective, Leslie, is we've done an awful lot here in the last decade as far as construction and projects and rebuilds. And, you know, every time you turn around, there's a dump truck or a backhoe driving by and everything's dug up. So to defer for 5 or 7 years some of these other projects that would have those types of impacts might not be such a bad thing. It's kind of a secondary bonus.
I need to leave it there. Anything you wanted to add, though?
No, that's it, Leslie. Thanks.
Well, with approvals in hand, the Park City Institute now putting plans into action in the studio with an update on how to make their pop-up concert series work this summer and the help they're going to need to make that happen. I have Executive Director Terry Orr. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So do you have the plans all figured out about how, who goes, or what goes where? And
yeah, it's certainly... fluid, I think, is the word that we like to keep using in the office. We know where the stage is going to be. We know where the buses are going to come in. The first concert out at Quinn's will be an experiment. There's just no two ways about it, to make sure that what we think in our heads will work will actually work.
Did you have to bring somebody in, to somebody that could figure out the logistics? I mean, I know you know what you need to make a series work, but that was with Deer Valley, and you had the restrooms and, you know, the concessions.
And
yes, exactly.
And existing. We've kind of done it in-house. You know, we've worked well with city staff, Jenny Dearson and Jonathan and Dave Gustafson and all those great folks who know how to put events together. But, yes, we'll be bringing in lovely porta-potties, you know, that are they are flushable and they're terrific. We will have food trucks, which is something that's great fun, and we've not had the opportunity to do that before. You can still bring in your own beverages, which is something that was a concern because our patrons really love doing that. All of the parking for the general seating will be off-site. So either at the Eccles Center or at Richardson Flat, we will have buses that will be shuttling folks then to the venue and dropping them off. Same thing at the end of the night and picking them up, taking them back to their cars. But because so many of our patrons and guests stay in hotels in the area, we really are encouraging. Take the bike, walk over. You know, usually the nights are beautiful in the summer, and it's really very easy to get to on the bike path.
Yeah. So are there any, like, are those e-bike locations?
We're working on the e-bike. We will have a bike valet for regular bikes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's kind of just start. So, I mean, in terms of, I mean, if you have, season or VIP tickets, then you'll be able, there is parking available for you?
Only for the sponsors and for handicapped. So, and for volunteers, which is something we're also here to talk about, because we need an army of volunteers. Once we started realizing day of show, everything has to pop up and everything has to disappear.
Okay, well, let's just talk a little bit about that. I mean, what who are you looking for?
Well, we have a great core of volunteers, as you know. You've been one for 20 years, and there are great benefits to it, meaning that you work a show and then you get tickets, in essence, to another show. And we try to take good care of you when you are with us with beverages and food in the summertime. Snacks, not meals, but you know, a little something-something on the hill. But to do this, we will need people to help with the buses and people to help with the physical setup that we've never had to do before. Park City Mountain has come up with a great idea, which they're going to have their team, about 50 volunteers, all volunteer for one show. So they're going to come and do the Chris Blue show, which we just love. So we thought, gosh, maybe there are other companies, groups in the community, service clubs who would love to say, I really can't commit for the whole summer, but I would love to have us take this show. So we didn't know quite how to get it out, and we appreciate KPCW helping us tell that message because we'd love to make that work.
So, like, you'd have, like, Mountain Trails Foundation volunteers or, you know, People's Health Clinic volunteers.
Or another corporation in town, another business in town who want to do something, you know, your Skull Candy or your Backcountry, and you want to have a project for your group in the summer. This one's kind of fun. You know, it's outdoors and you get to hear the concert.
How many volunteers do you think you need?
Well, we're thinking that 50 per show is probably what we need. So it's any number that you can come up with that gets you there over the course of 9 shows.
If people hear this and want to help, how, I mean, what do they do?
Yeah, just give us a call at the Park City Institute. And for right now, Morgan can answer those calls. Any of us can, but you know, you can ask for Morgan.
All right. So once we get to the venue from the bus, where's the box office? Where are we picking up tickets?
We are going to really encourage folks to pick up all their tickets before day of show. So, yes, there will be a small box office there. We're trying to avoid the whole will call thing and to have folks get their tickets before. But we will have a tent there to do that.
Okay.
And it'll probably be up by the ice rink.
And then in terms of, it's always been chairs on one side, lawn, sitting on the lawn on another. Are you still doing that?
Absolutely. Folks love bringing in their own chairs and their blankets, and it just makes more sense to separate that so it's not, so the visualization is still good of the stage. But we're going to learn with this concert because the stage is going to be elevated instead of down, and the ground is flat instead of on an incline. So how we view the stage and how that venue works, we'll learn a lot.
So will you be providing members early access then to those?
As before, yes. So there'll still be the early access for those people who have a certain level of membership.
Okay.
And that is $175. And that has benefits all year long. And that was really the other thing we wanted to talk about is lots of folks have said, I don't know how I can help. How can I help with this transition this summer? And one of the simplest ways is we know whether it's any nonprofit or whether it's a newspaper that we're all trying to save. I just watched a great piece on the New York Times documentary about it. And at the end, it was basically, we need to subscribe. Well, the same thing is true. We need to be a member. So if you value what we do, memberships start at $49 and go up to $1,000. There's a monthly payment plan, so it doesn't have to bite all at once. But it really matters. And it really matters to have that level of involvement.
All right. Again, people are able to bring in their food and beverages. And I mean, are you going to have like trailers behind the buses or something, you know, when you got your chair and your picnic basket and your cooler and that all fits on the bus, huh?
Well, it fits underneath the bus. So there are considerations. And the chairs, you know, are the same as they've always been. So if you can roll a basketball underneath them, it's too high. So the small legged chairs so we can all still see the stage.
Or it may be easier just to enjoy some of the food that you're going to have. How many food trucks you're going to have available?
We're looking at 4 to 5, both in terms of how that serves the population. We're capped at 2,500 for our concerts this summer, so how many bodies we need to feed. But we also know, as you say, so many people love to bring their own picnics in. So, again, we'll learn as we go. And beverages there as well.
All right. Anything else that we need to talk about?
No, I think that's it. Just if anyone has any questions about how they can volunteer or how they can participate in the season, we're still having folks sign up to be sponsors, and we have different opportunities with banners and sponsorships than we've had before. Just give us a call over at the Institute. Ask for me or Mo, and we're happy to answer questions.
655-8252.
That's it.
Okay. Terry, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
Terry Orr is Executive Director of the Park City Institute. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW.